You are listening to Faithless Brewing, a Magic the Gathering podcast for the rogue deck builder. Each week, we design new decks in Modern and Pioneer. We put our creations to the test and share our findings on the air. Today, we kick off our Kaldheim season with a look at Tybalt, Cosmic Imposter, and his alter ego, Valky, God of Lies. We vet all the options for cheating Tybalt into play and propose six new decklists to find out if the juice is worth the squeeze. That's all coming up on today's brew session. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Faithless Brewing Podcast. I am David Robertson, joined by Damon Alexander.
Hello.
And the CEO of the Faithless Brewing Podcast, Cave Dan. Daniel?
Hey, what's up?
Not too much. And this is Brewing Week 1 for the Kaldheim season. We are going to start looking at some of these sweet cards, proposing some decks, and trying them out in leagues. The first cards we are going to concern ourselves with are the black and blue dual face gods. First up is Valky, God of Lies. The backside is Tybalt, Cosmic Imposter. Just a quick reminder to people, Valky, God of Lies is one and a black for a 2/1 legendary creature god. When Valky enters the battlefield, each opponent reveals their hand. For each opponent, exile a creature card they revealed this way until Valky leaves the battlefield. Choose a creature exiled with Valky with converted mana cost X. Valky becomes a copy of that card. And then the Planeswalker side is 5 black red for a 5 loyalty legendary Planeswalker Tybalt. As Tybalt enters the battlefield, you get an emblem with you may play cards exiled with Tybalt, the Cosmic Imposter, and you may spend mana as though it were mana of any color to cast these spells. Tybalt +2s to exile the top card of each player's library. A -3s to exile target artifact or creature. And -8, an ultimate if you will. Exile all cards from all graveyards. Add 3 red to your mana pool. So Dan, there's a lot of text on both sides of these cards. Plus the dual face cards itself is very confusing. So can you just kind of walk us through some of the ins and outs of how this card just functions before we start to talk about the brews?
Oh my gosh, yeah. So I usually like to do like a little rules check-in on every card before we start actually theory crafting and brewing. And this one was like, we got to do it twice. This is one of the marquee cards of the set. And I've been hearing a lot of strange stuff thrown about on Twitter, on different podcasts, on articles. There's a lot of misunderstanding, I think. So I just kind of walk through just each half of the card and just clear up a few things. They say that reading the card explains the card, and that's mostly true. So let's just start with the Valky. So this enter the battlefield trigger of the opponents reveal their hands. This is templated the same way as Kitesail Freebooter. It is until Valky leaves the battlefield. So this is not the old templating that you might be familiar with on cards like Tide Hollow Sculler or Mesmeric Fiend if you're a real paper boomer. This is the new templating that's supposed to prevent any shenanigans. Basically, if you take a creature, they can always get it back by removing Valky. That continues to be true even if you activate the X ability, and this is where I think some people are confused. So if you do successfully transform Valky into a copy of one of the creatures that he has stolen, Valky will permanently become that creature. It erases all of Valky's other abilities, but the card still knows that it has the creature stolen away. So your opponent can still destroy your Valky, which is now something else, and they will get their card back. The card hasn't like forgotten that or anything like that.
If there's any C++ programmers out there, this is known as resource acquisition is initialization, where no matter how the object is destroyed in memory, it releases the memory back to the operating system.
Exactly what Damon's saying. I have no idea what Damon's talking about, but I assume that's right. I guess the shortcut is that anytime a card names itself in its rules text, that's kind of shorthand for this card, or actually this specific instance of this card. And the same thing applies to the emblem that the Tybalt side gives you. It says, you may play cards exiled with Tybalt Cosmic Imposter. That only refers to this exact copy of Tybalt. It doesn't refer to like future Tybalts, although future Tybalts will, in theory, give you their own emblems. Unless they get stifled or something. So those are the main things that need to be cleared up. In terms of like the details of playing with this, you can activate X at instant speed. You can do it in response to removal. So there's kind of like, you know, let's say you've saw they had a Tarmogoyf and you've taken the Tarmogoyf, you can activate it. If they try to bolt the Velki in response, you can pay two again and copy the Tarmogoyf again, that kind of thing. Those, I think, are the main points that people are stumbling on. And that's not even getting into the double-faced nature of the card, and that opens a whole different can of worms.
Yeah, I mean, we're just getting used to these whole MDFCs to begin with. So as a quick refresher, with MDFCs, the front side, which you can figure out by the single up arrow, not the up and down arrow, on the upper left of the card. I still don't really know what that means, or what it symbolizes, but it means exactly that. So Velki is always the card that's technically face up in your hand. And so, for example, a Duress can't hit Tybalt because it counts as a creature in your hand. Likewise, in Library and Graveyard, this is Velki as a creature and not anything else. And likewise, if it gets flickered or enters the battlefield in some sneaky way, then you're going to get the front side, which is Velki. You don't get to kind of choose as it enters the battlefield. Now, when you make the choice is when you cast the card. And this creates a kind of a big confusing swath of when you can kind of cheat it as Tybalt and when you're going to get a Velki out of it. And so the best way to think about this is that whenever you're casting the card, you get to choose which half you're casting. But if you're told to cast a card that has a CMC less than, for example, 4, you can't pick the Tybalt side, just because, of course, you can't. It doesn't have CMC less than 4. So if you start reading a bunch of cards that will do this, you'll understand which ones will work and which ones won't. So, for example, a card like Release to the Winds says you can cast the card without paying its mana cost. So when you choose to cast the card, you can just pick, do I want Velki or Tybalt? Probably Tybalt. Likewise, cards like Aetherworks Marvel, Descendant's Path, Tybalt's Trickery, these cards all let you cast a card without paying its mana cost, and so boom, you get to cast the Tybalt half if you want. Likewise, the Cascade cards, Bring to Light, Spellqueller, etc., these all look like they won't let you cast it, but if you read what happens, Bloodbright Elf says, exile cards until you hit a card with CMC less than this card's casting cost, you may cast it without paying its mana cost. So boom, the magic phrase, you may cast it without paying its mana cost, occurs. The check only happens to figure out where you stop on the Cascade, and so therefore you can choose to get Tybalt out of Bloodbright Elf. Similar story with Bring to Light, Spellqueller, Treasure Keeper, etc. They check the CMC first when just selecting a valid card to begin with, but when you cast it, you're just casting without paying the mana cost. The contrast to this is cards like Fires of Invention or, you know, Stram's Expertise or the other Expertise cards or As Foretold, etc., etc. These ones say you may cast a card with CMC, 4 or less or whatever, without paying its mana cost. Therefore, Tybalt is not a card with CMC 4 or less, and so it's not a valid choice. And so you can only choose Velki. They have to be worded differently that says, like, choose a card with CMC less than the lands you have in play or whatever, you may cast that card without paying its mana cost or something kind of clunky like that. And that's just not how they read. They check the CMC as they're letting you cast it without paying the cost.
So one of the key differences is often the reference to the word card instead of spell. So Cascade allows you to cascade to a card that is less than the CMC, and then you may cast that card, but not that spell. So that's what allows you to sort of pick the half. The Expertise cards were actually errated to reference spell specifically. That's why it doesn't work. And that's something that Matt Sabak has actually has outlined as a guideline, is when it looks at the card, you may cast that card. As long as it does not specify, that creature spell, that instant spell, etc. The generic word card is what is often allowing these cards to cheat the side of Velki we might be more interested in into play.
Yeah, which kind of brings us to our next question. is this card any good?
Yeah, how perfect of a case study? It could range anywhere from just complete trap to utterly broken. And my initial reaction was that this card's a trap. Because I think that people, when they start actually shuffling up Velki and casting it, are going to be disappointed in just the front side of the card. For a couple of reasons. I mentioned Kite Sailor Freebooter as just how the mechanic works, but also just comparing those two cards, they cost the same amount of mana, and Freebooter, I think, is just a much better effect. It takes a removal spell, or it takes, you know, a combo piece, let's say. So it kind of protects itself and is much more disruptive, whereas Velky taking a creature means that it's probably not taking something too important. You know, you'll look at their hand, you'll see they maybe have a creature, and you'll also see that they have a Fatal Push, which can then kill the Velky, maybe after tricking you into spending some mana onto activating Velky if you didn't realize that they were going to get the creature back. So I don't think that the front side is going to be worth a whole lot. On top of that, if you do succeed in copying a creature that does not going to give you an Enter the Battlefield triggers, that's mostly a downside with a couple notable exceptions. The biggest ones being if you steal a Kroxa or an Uro, copy that, actually you don't have to sacrifice it. So it could range from being pretty weak to exceptionally great if the dream scenario happens and Velky survives, steals Uro, and becomes Uro himself. So essentially that's what we're dealing with on the front half of Velky, and that's the side you're going to have the most opportunities to cast.
Yeah. As a counterpoint, I'm not sure that I like the comparison of Freebooter as much. If you're playing just like, I don't know, like a red-black deck, and you play Freebooter and you take their Lightning Bolt, then it's kind of like they bolted your Freebooter, and you're left with like a 1-2, which is fine. It's not even that good sometimes. Like, they play a Sweeper later in the game and they get a Bolt back in their hand, so it's kind of worse than them bolting your Freebooter, giving you a residual 1-2. And so the thing is, what makes Freebooter shine is a deck like Humans, where it can scout the way for a Meddling Mage or boost a Champion of the Parish, etc., etc., all the various human synergies. But Freebooter itself doesn't see a ton of play in any format without that kind of tribal base. Whereas Velky has meaningful upside. You know, this Uro thing, that's no joke. Even just copying a Tarmogoyf for a Magmatic Chandler or a Seasoned Pyromancer, or maybe not Seasoned Pyromancer.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. I mean, if we're talking about Modern, how many creatures are just good without their Enter the Battlefield trigger? If we're talking about Pioneer, I guess I still have the same question. I'm not convinced there are that many creatures that you can copy and upgrade Velky significantly.
Yeah. I think the key question here is, like, when the front side is it bad against the things that your deck will be good at through other reasons? Like, maybe it's because, you know, a deck like Humans, you know, Velky is sort of okay. You can steal, like, a Champion of the Parish or Phantasmal Image or whatever. It's not that great. But Tybalt's probably pretty good against a Humans deck, and if you're playing like a Jund deck trying to cycle into or cascade into Tybalt, your whole deck is good against them. On the other hand, Velky and Tybalt are both pretty trash against Ad Nauseam.
Yeah, so I think this is a huge question. I think I've personally just like swiveled back and forth on this. I was really down on it, and then I started drawing up some lists, and I was like, maybe, you know, maybe if I'm starting with Thoughtseize, everything is going to go exactly the plan. I'll protect the Velky and it's going to be beautiful. There are some incidental traits that Velky has. You know, it is a legend, so it enables Mox Amber. It works with new friends like Essica, God of the Tree, or Kolvori, God of Kinship. You can fetch it off the World Tree, for example. On the other hand, it's a legend that can be bad if you're actually like trying to fill your deck with these. Suddenly, if you draw two Velkys at once, it's like you basically mulligan. The second copy is not going to do anything for you.
Until you have seven mana.
Until you have seven mana, exactly.
Yeah, plus one toughness. Obviously, Ren 6 kills this very easily. lots of things kill things with one toughness, especially in Modern. So Freebooter does dodge a few of those effects.
So if we flip to the backside and consider Tybalt Cosmic Imposter, it's a seven mana Planeswalker, so it should be awesome. Although it's probably not worth seven mana. When I actually sit down and think about like what will happen when I have Tybalt in play, I think I'm going to probably plus one right away. That's going to exile one of my cards, one of theirs. It's kind of like a draw two, except that one of those cards came off the opponent's deck, and those are usually weaker than the cards in your deck, just because you know, you won't be able to take advantage of any synergies that a lot of decks are just built that way now. You can't use your opponent's cards as effectively as you can use your own. The minus eight essentially draws both graveyards, so it's kind of the same thing. The minus eight and the plus one kind of depend very much on the rest of the decks. The minus three is the most attractive one, although that does take Tybalt down to two loyalty. So minus three is an immediate removal spell, and then eventually you can recast the thing that you destroyed, or exiled, sorry. So it's kind of like a slow control magic effect, and that's quite powerful, but that alone would not be worth seven mana. I'm not even sure if that'd be worth five mana. If you can do that, play the Tybalt minus three, and then Tybalt lives to spend another turn cycle or two on the battlefield to accrue more card advantage, then we're talking. But all told, I'm just not convinced that the Tybalt half is worth seven. I'm not even sure it's worth five mana.
Yeah, I think the Tybalt is probably about as powerful as the five mana Teferi, which I think of as the best five mana Planeswalker of all time. So if you think of it in that terms, maybe you're getting more than you should for 5 mana, if you're someone that thinks maybe Teferi's a little too powerful for a 5 mana Planeswalker. But I don't think, yeah, I think it's probably worth, you know, we can't do fractions of mana, but 5 point something between 5 and 6 mana. And a lot of the things we're lining up here, you know, we're really bending our deck to play cards that maybe aren't of the appropriate quality, including the front half of this, in order to try to sort of like cheat in a, I would say, a 5 mana Teferi level Planeswalker into play. Now we can do that turns early, turns ahead of time. -3ing to 2 loyalty means that not only the burn that's available in Modern kills it, the burn that's available in Pioneer also kills it. Stomp is the card that I would really highlight there. So if you're exiling whatever red creature and it's getting stomped and you spent 2 cards to do that, that is pretty tough.
I'm a little bit more into Tybalt than you guys are. Its loyalty just moves up so fast. It goes from 5 to 7. Teferi is certainly a strong card. It's much better in some ways because it's kind of a 3-mana Planeswalker. That's really what makes Teferi so strong. But the thing is, like, besides failing the Field of the Dead test, which this card does, it loses to Field of the Dead and doesn't interact with it properly. Other than that, it's like, it's strong. It comes down on 5, it goes to 7. If you downtick, you can cast their creature or whatever you exiled. And so maybe you spend 2 cards to do it, but you get to cast it now. That's powerful. And the thing is that it's going to uptick. It's just so hard to beat. You know, you remember Oko. Obviously, Oko came down much, much earlier. But maybe we can cheat Tybalt into play at a similar time. Oko has infinite loyalty. Same with Tybalt. Like, you, at a certain point, you just can't race this card.
So we got some interesting comparisons on the table right now. We've got 5 mana Teferi and Oko as comparisons. Maybe I misspoke. I think what I was trying to say earlier was that Tybalt at 4 or 4.5 mana would feel fair to me. I don't think this Tybalt half is very good at all. And comparing it to Teferi is a travesty, David. That's a travesty. Teferi is so much better than this. The biggest reason, I think, is that Teferi actually wins the game with his Teferi emblem. And the Tybalt, all of his loyalty abilities combined just cannot deal 20 damage to them. The reason this is going to come up, as we're going to see, is that, like Damon said, you can cheat Tybalt into play pretty regularly if you're willing to bend your entire deck around it. If you're willing to like use one of these tricksy methods, like Cascade notably, to get Tybalt reliably into play on turn 3 or maybe even turn 2. But you've bent your deck a lot, and now Tybalt actually has to do all the legwork to actually turn that into a win. And I'm not actually sure that Tybalt is capable of that because his +1 and -8 depend on like what the rest of your deck is doing. And also, it just doesn't disrupt them at all. All he can do is remove an artifact or a creature.
Yeah, I mean, certainly if this card was just Tybalt Cosmic Imposter, no front half, and therefore potential to cheat into play somehow, this card is absolutely not constructed playable. But the thing is, like, if your plan is to play Valky and sometimes you play Tybalt, you know, you flood out a lot of the time in playing Jund. Every time you draw a run in 6, you're guaranteed to flood, essentially. And the thing is that cards that are kind of quote-unquote bad constructed cards win games when the situation lines up correctly for them.
Well, I mean, I think both halves of this card are bad. But as we've said before, like a bad 2-mana play sometimes is better than no 2-mana play at all. You know, it is just a road bump sometimes just against Death Shadow or, you know, whatever. And then sometimes you're flooded and you just draw it and pay 7, but you never want it in your deck for those modes. You're playing this card because you're trying to cheat it, the 7. You're trying to get the 7-mana Planeswalker, which is worth somewhere, according to you guys, from 4 to 5.5 mana, and you want to play it for less than that. So I think without a way to cheat it, you'd never play it. No one's going to ever play this card fair, I don't think, in Modern or Pioneer. Maybe Pioneer, but in Modern, I just don't think it's even close. I think each of the halves is bad, but as Damon says, the slightly bad cards in both modes are actually a little better than you think, because there are times when it's better than doing nothing. Huh. But if you couldn't cheat this card into play, if you had to play it as written, I don't think this card sees any constructive play at all, basically.
Right, right. I will say, though, that I've certainly won some games hardcasting an Akum Warrior. I had better plans to Flicker Wisp it, but sometimes the game goes long, and you're like, I have a 6-mana 4/5 trample. Nobody in their right mind plays that as a main deck card in Modern, but there are plenty of Modern game states where actually that's pretty good.
And I do want to highlight, Jiggy Wiggy kind of pinged us in our Discord and said, you know, you guys are kind of underrating the front side. And he did bring up a great point, which is the Temur Reclamation list and Pioneer don't play any 2-mana removal at all. So on the play, if you play this on 2 and take their Uro, they cannot kill it on their second turn. And you, on your turn 3, just turn it into Uro and win the game. So I think just having that line, obviously a few things have to go right there to just beat the second most popular deck in the entire format, that is just worth something. You know, like, just makes the front half worth playing. You know, maybe that happens every 10th game or whatever, but I mean, just a free win. You don't have to do anything. You just have to hit your first three land drops. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, I guess the upside is there, and I need to remind myself of that. And I guess we're going to find out when we test these decks this week.
Of course, if they don't have an Uro in hand, then you have a 2-1, and it will die to a shark token.
Yep. The Lord giveth, and he taketh away.
So, taking our cue from David, I think we're going to start thinking about ways to cheat Tybalt in, or at least building decks that have multiple ways to unlock the backside, the exciting side of Velki. So we're going to start off in Modern, because I think the Cascade mechanic is probably the easiest way to do this.
Sure,
let's do it.
All right, so the first deck I want us to consider is the most all-in version possible. This is based on the premise that a Cascade spell, of which there are several at 3 mana, can unlock Tybalt, and it can do so consistently. So you'll have the option to build a deck that can find Tybalt off every Cascade spell. So let's say you start off with Violent Outburst, Demonic Dread, and Ardent Plea. So we're just going to go all in. These are all the 3 mana options, because Charlas is not legal, unfortunately. For Velki, and then the rest of our deck is going to try to make this happen quickly. So let's play Simeon Spirit Guides, Chance for the Tangle, and Gemstone Caverns. Full sets of each of those. Serum Powder, just to get the opening hand nicely, get this set up as quickly as we can. That's going to take up most of our deck space, but we still have room for some interactive spells, so I would say Bonecrusher Giants as a 3 that you can cast on turn 2. Dismember, likewise. Removal spell for 1 mana that avoids being hit by Cascade. And then finally, Lovestruck Beast in some number. I'm not sure how many. The reason for Lovestruck Beast, I think, is that A, it's a roadblock. B, it can use your Chancellor mana on turn 1 if you don't have anything else to do. And probably C, and most importantly, Demonic Dread needs a creature in play for you to even cast it. So you have to do a little bit of work there. You can't rely on them having played something. So you have Lovestruck Beast can make a little human. You can also play the land Forbidden Orchard, which gives the opponent a spirit token, and that's another way to turn on the Demonic Dread. And that's pretty much the entire deck. The principle is that, you know, hopefully on turn 2, or maybe even on turn 1, you'll play your Cascade spell, get a Tybalt, and see how far that takes you. And if that doesn't get you there, you can just Cascade again and get another Tybalt. What do you guys think of this concept?
I think when you're talking about an interaction, if you want to find out it is broken, I think this is exactly the right way to start. Is just say, look, if this interaction is good enough, let's just do it as early and as often as possible, and we'll find out quickly, right? Like, you'll be 2 or 3 leagues in, and you'll be like, okay, you know, I'm accepting that I lose to Force of Negation or whatever, but I can beat all these other decks. Or maybe you're saying, even when I do my thing and on turn 1 and 2 and I'm plussing it twice, I'm still somehow losing those games. This is kind of what you need to find out is, do I need to even be doing anything else? Maybe this is just everything I've been wanting. And the only way to do it is something like this. I do think that a lot of these card choices are very clever. Obviously, Demonic Dread requiring a creature is causing us to bend in a few ways. Giving them tokens with Forbidden Orchard is not trivial, since we're just hoping our Planeswalker gets there. We don't have that many blockers, but you know, we have to do what we have to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is just a tough question of how this lines up against modern decks. I think there's a bunch of decks where a turn 2 or 3 Tybalt will probably be good enough, and there's a lot of decks where, well, if you play Tybalt and they play Karn Liberated, I think we know who wins that one. If you play Tybalt and they play Force of Negation, also a pretty clear outcome. Even the red-black kind of Chandler decks play some Dreadbores.
That would be so sad if that happened. If I lose to a Dreadbore in 2021, I think we have to pack it in.
And the tricky thing is that because of your Cascade plan, you can't afford to play Thoughtseizes or Veil of Summers, typical cards that are good against combo or good against counters.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest problem. It's nice that between Bonecrusher, Lovestruck Beast, and Dismember, you have some removal and some creatures you can play that work with Cascade. But there's no like hand disruption. There's very little disruption of any kind. And unfortunately, the Tybalt side of Velki doesn't disrupt them either for the most part. So I think that's probably going to be the downfall of this deck, if I had to guess. There are cards like Rise Fall, you could play that just gets some cards out of the hand. But beyond that, it's pretty tough.
Yeah. On the other hand, I mean, if you do have some sideboard cards that cost 1 or 2 mana, you'd probably be able to hit them pretty regularly.
Oh, yeah. Cascade into Burnt and Forge Tender every single time.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, you could certainly imagine, like, against Dredd, you're just, like, plussing all the time. They're picking away at it so it can't exile both graveyards, and they just eventually kill it and then you before you can actually, like, win with your exiled cards.
Yeah, so what's the best, like, 3 CMC anti-Dredd card? I mean, I guess you just play Ley Lines.
Yeah, I think Fairy Macabre. I think a lot of the technology that Living End decks used to use can be incorporated into this style of strategy. So another thing you could do, and this is maybe version 2, is instead of going for turn 1 Tybalt, you could hedge your bets a little bit, play a little bit slower, and play a little bit better cards. If you're listening closely to the deck I just described, all of that stuff was in Jund colors except for Ardent Plea, which is somehow a blue-white card. If you're willing to just like not play Ardent Plea, you have much better mana. You can play Bloodbraid Elf instead, which is a card that like some modern decks still do play. And you're a little bit slower, but you now have a responsible mana base. And maybe if you're willing to go a little slower, you take out the green Chancellors. That gives you some more slots for things like Fulminator Mage, maybe Beast Within, Seasoned Pyromancer. These are all cards I might consider. The other change you might make is you might want to incorporate a second Cascade hit. Crashing Footfalls is one that we've talked about in the past. Cascade into that gets you 2 Rhinos. It's a bad card to draw, but a pretty wonderful card to cascade into. So if you're considering that to be a similar power band to Tybalt, you could build a deck that played maybe both Valky and Crashing Footfalls. And this would be like a turn 2.5, turn 3 Tybalt, because you'll still play Spirit Guides.
Yeah, I mean, I get a little nervous here. Like, every time I've Bloodbraid Elf into Simeon Spirit Guide, it's just like, all right, that's, you know, you win this one. I offer my right hand to you, kind of opponent. I'm not sure why we're playing Beast Within, just because that's like a catch-all card. Is that the thought?
Kills opposing Tybalts.
Exactly. We want to come prepared for the new meta. Yeah, maybe that's just foolish. I don't know.
Yeah, speaking of which, that is one big downside of Tybalt. He doesn't hit Planeswalkers. But when it comes to this deck, I like the turn 1 deck better. I think that a turn 3 Tybalt is a lot worse than a turn 1 Tybalt, or even turn 2. And the cards you're getting, I don't think are worth what... like, you still can't play Thoughtseize, and just having a few Beast Withins or Seasoned Pyromancers, I don't think is enough to make up for that.
I think that's right. And I think that because you're not able to have access to that, you're just not gaining enough. So if you're willing to actually include things like Thoughtseize and Inquisition in your deck, now you have the chance of cascading into it. And at that point, you probably have a better deck, more versatile, more well-rounded. But you start to make a series of cascading decisions for your cascade deck, and you end up with something that's much closer to just traditional Jund. So I think that's probably the home where I dare say Valky will see the most success. David, how do you think a deck like that would shape up?
Yeah, so I have here a sort of modern Loki Jund list. The list tries to adhere to certain cards that are played in Jund. Some of them are a little bit of a variant. Obviously, we're playing for Valky, God of Lies, which is not a card on power level would be in Jund. I think the one interesting thing here is that we're basically playing 12 cards that can discard. So that's 4 Magmatic Chandler, 4 Liliana of the Veil, and 4 Seasoned Pyromancer. And the thought is we either play Valky or we discard Valky to one of these effects. And then because we've bent our mana base to be mostly swamp oriented, we're actually going to try to combo with Witch's Cottage and Bloodbraid Elf. So Witch's Cottage is the unheralded, along with the white and green ones. Although I guess the white ones also play in Pioneer. it can't put an instant on top of your deck, but it can put a creature on top of your deck. So if Valky's in your graveyard, you have 3 swamps and a fetch land. You fetch your Witch's Cottage, you put Valky on top, and then when you cast your Bloodbraid Elf, you know you're going to hit it. You don't have to worry about not getting to play Thoughtseize, not getting to play Inquisition of Kozilek, not getting to play Fatal Push, for instance. So you can always raw dog it. You have a 1 in 8 shot of just hitting it if you just Bloodbraid Elf in the dark. But you can control that, I think, with the Witch's Cottage. And so I think I'm not unique in proposing a similar list to this. I think this is something people are going to try out, and we'll find out, you know, it's the vestiges of Jund, which is not a very good deck in Modern, and you're missing some of the cards that made Jund actually very good. You know, there's no Ren and Six in this list, for instance, but you are trying to see, all right, we're going to turn for Valky some percentage of the time here. Let's see how good that is.
Could you just play Ren and Six?
I think I would, personally. I would probably... Maybe I'd at least play 3 Ren and 6, and if I have to trim a Valky to do that, that's okay. But I'm noticing also that you're a little bit heavier on 3s in this sketch than classic Jund is, so I might find some room there too. It's just too good to pass up, especially with the Channelers in the deck.
Yeah, and I think honestly hardcasting Tybalt is another reason why Ren and 6 is good.
Yeah, well, I will just say, though, Ren and Six, when you're having to not play that many basics, is going to just do, like, six damage to you to cast on turn two. And if you're Thoughtseizing on turn one, that means you're just doing eight every game. So it's difficult to do if you're going to bend your entire mana so that Witch's Cottage is always on, basically. Something to consider. So, yeah, obviously, Ren and Six, very powerful card. I think you guys are making good points. And Ren and Six does fetch lands to find the Witch's Cottage, but there is a tension when you need to fetch all these, you know, you don't have your red-black fast land into basic forest openings where Ren and Six is not double bolting you in the face for the privilege of getting to play him. It.
Well, let's not overlook the Urborgs. I mean, you put two Urborgs in the mana base, so those can undo your non-swamp plays, and they also let you stash fetch lands in play. Given that you have Channelers and Seasoned Pyromancers as well, like maybe you could play just like a bunch of Urborgs, maybe go for three copies and just plan on finding it that way.
Yeah, but then again, you have to be considerate of the fact that Urborg is going to prevent you from turn two Ren and Sixing a reasonable amount of the time. So my point is just the mana is asking you to do a lot of stuff. You need to have three swamps in play when you have a fetch land in play. And so that does make playing a red-green two mana card more difficult. I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm just saying it is a trade-off. You have to consider it.
Fair point. There's a forgotten Cascade card from Modern Horizons called Throes of Chaos. It's a 3 and a red sorcery. It just says Cascade. So you cast it and you get something else. But it has Retrace, which means that when it's in the graveyard, you can discard any land to cast it again. And I'm noticing here that you have a number of discard outlets between Channelers, Seasoned Pyromancers, and Lilianas. If we're adding the Ren and Sixes, you're going to have lands in play. So maybe like this can be your extra copy, or copies even, of Bloodbraid Elf that can just live in the graveyard. Thinking about this Witch's Cottage line, it's probably not going to happen until fairly late in the game, right? Turn five-ish?
Turn four?
Well, if you've got exactly the right lands and you draw Bloodbraid Elf, fetch Witch's Cottage that turn, and somehow I have Velky in the graveyard. I mean, that's tough. I think realistically it won't happen until a little bit later.
What Velky's if he's a 2/1, he'll die to anything. But it might be hard to have him in the graveyard by turn four, I don't know.
Well, no, you just might not draw it.
Sure, sure.
And you might figure out after the first time you cast it that you just don't want this many Velkys in the deck. But you still want Owls to like find it eventually as like a finisher. Anyway, I'm wondering if we could consider like a Throes as an extra copy of this.
Well, when you say it was a forgotten card, Dan, to me it never was. I did not know this card existed. I don't remember looking at it in the Modern Horizon spoiler. I like had to Google it. I was like, what the hell is this? I think it's a really interesting card. I mean, it's much worse than Bloodbraid Elf, I think. Not only is Bloodbraid Elf a card that can attack Planeswalkers, etc., Bloodbraid Elf also blocks. I mean, we keep talking about we're going to get this Planeswalker in play and just cruise to victory behind it. I mean, we do still need to stop their Uro, etc., or their bunch of crappy little humans or whatever. So I do like the fact that Bloodbraid Elf is a body in the way. But yeah, maybe this is the fifth effect of that card. Like you say, something we can stash in the graveyard. The one thing I do want to flag is the reason that Magmatic Channeler is actually good in these like black-red lists is because it helps you find Blood Moon. It looks at three cards basically to find it. And we don't get to play Blood Moon. So I think Magmatic Channeler, it has created the illusion that it's more powerful than it is. We're basically like getting the least amount out of it. We're trying to sort of tutor our way for a Bloodbraid Elf that we can't even cast on turn three. Mm-hmm. And hoping that we're looting a Velky away while doing it. But we never get to play Bloodbraid Elf. Excuse me, we never get to play Blood Moon, even if we went straight black red for the card you're describing, Dan. So we, you know, get rid of Bloodbraid Elf. We don't worry about running six anymore. Maybe we're just straight red black. We still don't get to play Blood Moon even with all that work because we still need to keep all these swamps in our list to turn on Witch's Cottage.
I mean, you can still play Blood Moon. I don't know. Like if it's against Tron, I think I will happily not have Witch's Cottage as a line.
Yeah, I mean, maybe.
And you could just naturally cascade into the Velky.
Yep, you always can do that. 12.5% chance at any time. You just got to believe.
Well, speaking of percentages, I do want to talk about one other Cascade style of deck. Now, this is one that probably by the time you're listening to this cast will have already been making the rounds and screenshots everywhere on Twitter, that kind of thing. Tybalt's Trickery. One in a red, instant, counters a spell, and then the controller of the spell mills a random number of cards and then starts flipping until they hit a spell of a different name than the one that was countered. Get to cast that one without paying its mana cost. Interesting tool if you're using it defensively, but potentially broken if you can counter your own thing, mill some cards, and then flip into something huge, something Emrakul-ish, let's say. People are going to be trying this. There's a couple different builds out there. One of them is like all lands except for exactly one Tibalt's Trickery and some Violent Outburst to find it, and then Emrakul's. But there's another build that has been circulating that plays more Cascade spells, but in exchange for that, risks failing. So Damon, do you want to like talk through how this deck is built, and then where could Velki fit in?
Yes, this deck features our typical launch plan of 4 Simeon Spirit Guide, 4 Chancellor of the Tangle. 4 Tibalt's Trickery is the, as Dan pointed out, the kind of centerpiece that lets us do all the cheating that we're going to do. And then the goal is to cascade into it with 4 Ardent Plea, 4 Violent Outburst, and 3 Demonic Dread. And then we have the payoffs. These are Emrakul's, Omniscience, a couple Kozilek's and Ulamog's, Chancellor of the Annex, just to also have, you know, more Chancellor effects if you're turboing out, and then just some lands. And so the goal is to play a Cascade spell on 3. It will always hit a Tibalt's Trickery, or in an alternate version, always hit either a Tibalt's Trickery or a Velki, which turns into Tibalt himself. And if you hit the Tibalt's Trickery, then you can choose to counter your original Cascade spell, and this gives you a shot at greatness. You could hit an Emrakul, or you could hit another Tibalt's Trickery.
Yeah, it's a really clever construction. I mean, I don't think that this is immediately obvious when we talked about the Trickery, that Cascade will find Trickery, and then what happens is that you're casting the Tibalt's Trickery with the Cascade spell still on the stack, so you actually have a target already there. Cascade both finds the Trickery and then provides something for you to counter. So it's pretty cool that this can happen. Cool, I'm using air quotes here, because it's kind of obnoxious that A, that it's random what the result is, and B, this is kind of not really magic. It's more like a math problem. So if you build the deck this way, I mean, you have some spectacular wins on turn 3 or turn 2 or turn 1 even, casting Emrakul, and you also just have some spectacular whiffs. So do you feel like adding Velki would actually improve your odds overall of like not getting something bad out of your Cascade?
Yeah, I think so, because when you... Okay, so you've cascaded in your Trickery cancel or counters your Cascading spell. Obviously, you can hit the Velki then, so that increases your density then. But the other thing is, if it hits another Cascader, it can cascade into Velki again. So you just give yourself a, like, you're increasing your fractional odds, but you increase your fractional odds in a bunch of other, like, outcomes after certain, like, outcomes. So at each branch of the tree, you've marginally increased your chance of hitting a non-bad card. Now the question becomes, is this card good enough? you've decreased your chance of fizzling, but the card that you're hitting is now, you know, not an Ulamog, it's not an Emrakul, it's not an Omniscience. It is the 7-mana Planeswalker that is maybe not capable of winning the game on its own in a way that maybe an Emrakul or whatever else might be.
Yeah, I mean, one way to think about this is that if you introduce Velki into this deck, it does 2 things for you. One is, it's another thing you could hit off your Cascaders instead of the Tibalt's Trickery, that in this case is a meaningful card, but obviously not as good as casting an Emrakul the Aeon's Torn. And then alternatively, if you hit the Tibalt's Trickery, then it gives you kind of a higher density of big spells to hit off of it versus the downside risk of hitting a Simeon Spirit Guide or a Tibalt's Trickery, which are both kind of the disaster outcomes and probably lead you to going into game 2. But the thing is that if the whole point of this deck is to go into like really big spells like Emrakul or Kozilek or Ulamog, these kind of Annihilator Eldrazi, you're saying that, well, I can help the plan by going for the whole point of the deck's plan of Tibalt's Trickery less often. And so if the whole point of this deck is that Tibalt's Trickery is a good hit and what we're building around, so we can in turn hit an Emrakul or Omniscience to Emrakul or any of these big spells, then saying, well, actually, I'm okay with hitting the A plan less often to make the A plan slightly better is possibly worth it, but doesn't seem right to me.
The other thing that's worth noting is, as a creature, it does give you a body for Demonic Dread. Not having a creature for Demonic Dread is a very real concern in a deck like this. So, you know, you could just play it on 2 and Demonic Dread target it on the next turn. I mean, that this deck is not guaranteed to have a creature. There's 4 Forbidden Caverns and no other cheap creatures. So if your opponent is not playing creatures early, when there's a bunch of decks in Modern that don't do that, you could have drawn your Cascader, Demonic Dread, but it won't cascade for you until you give a body to summon some demons.
Right. So, Damon, when you're describing it, it sounds like this is like a cowardly way to build the deck. like we're like, oh yeah, we're going to roll the dice, you know, Tibalt's Trickery. Actually, I actually only want to hit Trickery some of the time, maybe less than half of the time. But I think, David, I mean, I'm persuaded by what you're saying. Like, that is another safety valve for Demonic Dread. It's also just another plan. You can sneak in. It does look at their hands, so you'll see if the coast is clear for force negation, that kind of thing. You know, we talked about the upside of hitting Uro or whatever. And I think a hidden downside of the trickery-only build is that you only have four copies of Tibalt's Trickery in the deck, and you might need to spin, like, multiple times in a game. If Trickery spins into another Cascade spell that uses up a second Trickery, and it's very possible that you could only actually get to go off twice, let's say, even though you have four Trickeries in the deck, because you just keep on having to respin and you lose the ability to go off. I'm not sure if that would come up or not.
I love how you're like, oh, you can check if the coast is clear. It's like, okay, the coast is not clear. What does your deck do? You just wait around? I mean, they're going to remand or whatever. Oh, coast isn't clear. I better draw to my 10 mana plus hard cast codes like Butcher of Truth.
Exactly. You just use Valky's X to transform your deck into something totally different.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, fair enough. This deck, I think, needs a little bit of tuning, whether or not you add the Valkyries or not. You know, the initial sketch just had a bunch of random Eldrazi besides Emrakul and Omniscience. I'm not even sure that's correct. I could envision a build of this that didn't play any uncastable Eldrazi, but instead went for just, like, stuff that's just good on 4 to 7 mana. And Primeval Titan is probably the best card you can think of for this, where if you Tibalt Trickery into a Primeval Titan, cool. And if you don't, yeah, you could probably still cast a Titan and kill him that way. Or maybe you should, like, run the numbers and do Through the Breach to complement your Emrakuls. Then you risk Tibalt Trickery into a Through the Breach when you don't have the right thing in your hand. But who knows? I haven't exactly crunched this out.
Yeah, these are some weird decks. I always wonder if, you know, in 6 weeks from now, there'll be some secret tech that somebody finds out that'll make this deck, like, the new Tier 1 menace of the format.
Yeah, I mean, I just am praying there isn't someone doing that. I mean, people should try. I think the effort to, like, break a tech like this is noble, but once they succeed, we know that Wizards will wait 6 months before banning it, so it doesn't matter how impressive it is. Just play Force of Negation. You just gotta play four Force of Negation. It's like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
Should have played around it.
I mean, there's other incidental stuff, too. Teferi Time Reveler absolutely shuts down Cascade 100%. Lavinia Azorius Renegade, if you're desperate. Even Roiling Vortex might be enough to stop a Cascade deck. So there's plenty of counterplay, especially in Modern.
Good news is you have 4 main deck counterspells for the opposing Teferis.
Exactly. All right, so shifting gears to round out the discussion, we don't have to Cascade into Valky. There's some other homes, especially in Modern, where I could envision someone considering Valky. I'll just name a couple possibilities, and you guys tell me if you think this is worth pursuing. So first of all, you can find this off Bring to Light. Niv-Mizzet Reborn is probably the only deck that consistently uses Bring to Light, though we haven't seen the Scapeshift build in a long time. I could see a situation where I want the option to Bring to Light for Tibalt. That's like a removal spell that sticks around to accrue value. I could even see some world in which we kind of return to the Blood Raid Elf versions of Niv-Mizzet and maybe play multiple Valkyries. Is that crazy?
Well, there was the kind of aggressively slanted Niv-Mizzet deck that wasn't as much a tap-out control deck as a 5-color mid-range deck that plays monsters and then tops it off with a Niv-Mizzet.
Yeah, I actually have... I've cast that spell to get a removal spell many times, and it was not a 7-mana Planeswalker that left behind all this value and also let me cast a creature. I do think it's kind of wild that, as you point out in these notes, Dan, when the Planeswalker enters play, there's actually a trigger. So you don't automatically get the emblem that lets you do this. So if they have an instant speed way to kill or bounce it, right. You don't actually get to do anything. It's crazy that they can actually kill it before it gets to activate any of its abilities or, you know, whatever, Into the Royal It or Brazen Borrow It or whatever. And so I'm imagining every time that happens, like, baby Jesus has to weep if you do all this work and it just gets Brazen Borrowed with the emblem trigger on the stack. It's just so sad.
I didn't even think about Brazen Borrower. I was like, nobody plays Assassin's Trophy. That's not even worth mentioning. But man, that would be super sad.
Yeah, much less Nimble Obstructionist.
Oh man, that would be sweet. I'm now dreaming the impossible dream.
All right, another possible home. Spell Queller is a card that you typically quell the opponent's spells. It's great, everything's fun. However, you can Spell Queller your own Valky. Cast Valky for 2, Violin a Spell Queller. Now you've got a Spell Queller with a Tibalt hidden underneath it. When the Spell Queller dies, it doesn't check the CMC of the card. So what if I took a home that was like a Aether Vial Spell Queller deck and I looked to see, like, are there any decks that would play, that would be in the market for a Tidehollow Scholar effect? Maybe some kind of blinky taxes thing. You could add Flicker Wisps. You could add maybe Wasteland Stranglers if you want to do some processing. And you could add Velki to a shell like this. I have a sketch here that's Aether Vials, Path to Exiles, maybe a couple Ephemerates. On 1 mana, on 2 mana, Tidehollow Scholars, Velkis, maybe an Alrund. On 3 mana, Flicker Wisp, Spell Queller, Wasteland Strangler, couple Skyclave Apparitions, Teferi Time Raveler, 4 of that, and maybe a Cosimo to round things out. In my mana base, I'd like some Glasspool Mimics. Do you think a deck like this is something worth trying for Velki?
I actually kind of like the look of this list. I think you have to go kind of more all-in on the Ephemerate. I would 100% cut all the Wasteland Stranglers. I don't think we need them. And the Cosima doesn't seem to do anything either. But the rest of the cards actually seem pretty good to me. It's actually like pretty reasonable, you know, just like vialing in a Tidehollow Scholar and blinking it is actually pretty good. I would actually maybe consider playing a couple Wall of Omens. That's just a generically powerful card. I would play 4 Ephemerates. I just love that card. I know Damon sort of was quick to identify it as maybe the most powerful white card in the format. Yeah, I would change a few cards around here, but I think that shell's interesting. I actually really like just playing like Esper Blink. it's an archetype I've enjoyed. I'm not sure again that Velki's going to be worth it, but this is, again, you just push all the levers to the max and see how often you can do it, and then find out the hard way, perhaps, if it is worth it.
Yeah, I have a couple of concerns with this deck. For example, Aether Vial with no one drops is kind of like a takes a little while to get ready to start cheating in your creatures. And so maybe we just need to add some like Giver of Runes or something. Hmm. They can help protect your Tidehollow Scholars. I like more Ephemerates just because they are good with the Scholars. They're good with Spell Queller, kind of good with Spell Queller. Great with Skyclave Apparition. But yeah, the deck is just like, these decks can be a little bit clunky in my experience. You're kind of relying on having like the right ETB creatures at the right time. They can only attack the game from a pretty narrow perspective.
Well, you get a little bit of hand disruption, a little bit of board disruption. What more do you need? You want to attack the graveyard? Just don't be greedy, Damon. You want card advantage? Come on.
Yeah, I would change a bunch of these numbers, but I would play a list like this for sure. I think that it would actually be pretty good.
All right, and one final home. So everything we've discussed so far has involved some way to unlock the Tybalt half, whether that's Cascade, whether that's Bring to Light, whether that's the suspicious Spell Queller on my own spell. This build here that I'm going to propose doesn't really do that. This is just testing the front side of Velki. With the addition of Kaldheim, there's actually a huge number of fairly cheap legends, you know, between 2 and 3 mana, centered around the color black and blue. I'm going to call this deck the Seer and Visions Podcast special, because if the Seer and Visions Podcast has been working with this Lazav, the Multifarious Kroxa shell for a couple of weeks now, they love this shell. It's Lazav, Kroxa, Emry, and Lurrus of the Dream Den, plus a selection of artifacts. Mox Amber being the big get, Mishra's Bauble, and then you have Engineered Explosives for some interaction. So what that core needs are just like a few more legends, just a few more legends to make the Amber worth it. And I think Velki could be that legend. You also get Aegon, God of Death, and Cosima, God of the Voyage. Both of these have pretty interesting backsides that are cheap artifacts in Throne of Death and the Omen Keel. Those help your Emry, and they also just prevent you from drawing too many of your legends. So I think that if you just started with a core like that, and maybe Velki is like the missing piece, additional legend, you maybe even have room for some Thalsi's, Inquisition, Fatal Push type stuff when you add it all up. Are you interested in trying something like this that's more interested in just the front half of Velki?
I'm not sure I trust just the front half of Velki. I think
that's where I come down. I agree with Damon.
I definitely don't trust the Cosima in a deck like this.
You don't trust Cosima? This is the new Smuggler's Copter.
You need way more fetch lands to make the front half good. And, you know, like you can crew the back half with Emry, I guess that's cool. And then you attack for 3 and they block.
Well, you crew it with Velki because it doesn't do anything else.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind of why it's here.
I mean, I certainly like the Lazav, Kroxa, Emry, Lurrus, Aegon. Like, that stuff's all, you know, okay. I'm willing to try that out. It's just the Velkis and the Cosimas seem like kind of like the weak links here.
Hmm.
I mean, to me, it's like a really cool synergy deck that just doesn't seem to have like very much power. You're really hoping to like kind of nut draw with your Lasav. Otherwise, I just don't think the deck is actually doing that much.
Yeah. I will say that Velki is definitely the mirror breaker.
Take their Lurrus, turn it into a Lurrus, buy back your own Mishra's Bauble.
Yeah, take their Kroxa, you know, you name it.
Yeah.
This deck is full of Valky hits.
Yeah.
So I'd say this deck is at least 50-50 in the mirror, so that's a good step.
Well, there's definitely room to iterate. If we don't like the Cosimas, you know, you could play something else there. Chandra Torch of Defiance is actually kind of nice with Valky. It can plus to add red mana and get you up to 7 if you're occasionally going to draw a Valky that way. Magda Brazen Outlaw is another cheap legend in the Grixis colors that actually randomly spits out some treasures. So you could try that instead just to have another way to unlock the Tibalt side. Or maybe just abandon Valky altogether. And you could even try the second Pioneer. Obviously you lose Mishra's Bauble and Engineered Explosives. But all the other legends that I mentioned, every single legend is from a recent set. So these are all Pioneer legal. So I think there's definitely something to explore here. And yeah, I agree that the power is going to come from Lazav plus Kroxa, but I'm curious to see whether Valky can be a complementary piece.
Yeah, and I guess to me, it's like we have all these great cards, and I think that's why the Serum Visions podcast was already interested in it before Valky existed. And Valky is literally just a body to like maybe turn on Mox Amber a little bit more. That just doesn't do enough for me. But I like a lot, you know, the shell is interesting. I just don't think Valky adds that much or anything.
Yeah, Magda is the only dwarf. It seems a little bit suspicious to me. I mean, it does ramp you, but it's not super fast. I mean, I guess if you have a Springleaf Drum, you're spinning out a free treasure a turn.
Yeah.
And Lotus Petal is banned in...
True.
Pioneer.
Yeah, I mean, you could dip into four colors and get Kinnan for even more explosive mana, and then you might actually get to 7 more frequently to cast the Tibalt. It's not totally crazy. You have Springleaf Drum and Mox Ambers. I don't know.
How does Kinnan's ability interact with Valky?
Well, it depends if it says put it onto the battlefield or cast it.
Yeah.
Cards that say put it on the battlefield do not unlock the back half.
Right.
Yeah, it says put it onto the battlefield.
Oh. So you can spend 7 mana to get Valky. That's pretty good. At instant speed.
All right. So we have a huge slate of decks here. I forgot to even mention the Living End sideboard juke. We've got about 8 different Valky lists here just in Modern. What do you guys think? Where should we start a testing? Any of these particularly excite you? Any guesses, predictions, which ones will pan out?
I think it might be worth, you know, the 20 minutes it takes to take the turn one Tibalt deck through a league. And then otherwise, I'm always a sucker for playing Niv-Mizzet.
Yeah, my instinct is that Valky is just not going to be good enough. But I think people will 5-0 with it in the first week because a bunch of people are going to be trying it. My desire would be to play the Esper Blink list with significant changes, but leaving your general core intact, Dan, because that's more my style. Yeah, that's probably where I'd start in Modern.
And I am personally addicted to Jund, so I'm probably going to try your Valky Jund list. I can't put down the Thoughtseize of the Inquisition, so I'm almost certainly going to try a deck like that. And I'm kind of intrigued by this cowardly build of Turbo Trickery, where like I want to get the Emrakul, but I don't really want it. I kind of want the Tibalt instead. So I might try that as well.
I do think it's worth pointing out that in these early builds, I would tend to just play more Valkyries than you think, quote unquote, in the platonic ideal it needs. Because I think you want to try out as early as possible what happens when you get the Planeswalker into play.
Somewhere outside this universe, there is a platonic ideal of a post-Kaldheim Modern deck.
But I'm just saying, like, so Dan made, which is a legitimate point, if we were trying to win a tournament tomorrow, I would not start out with 4 Valkyries in my deck. You know, I'd start out with 3 and I'd replace one with a Renin 6 or whatever. But my point is, to see how good the Valky ability is, I would want to maximize my chances to put it in play on turn 4, like Dan was talking about, just to try it out, maximize my chances of putting in play on turn 1 and 2, and then just see what it does. Like, oh, in those situations, I'm winning a lot, and so I'm actually willing to bend my mana base to always, you know, be able to BBE into it on turn 4, or it's like, man, every time I do this, you know, it's just getting countered, it's just getting remanded because Bloodbraid Elf is casting it so late in the game, so that's not worth it.
I like a different approach. I think I'm going to try a single Valky and Blue Moon. You see a lot of cards in the deck every game, so you will cast it a lot.
Yes. You'll add there's no Grixis Tri-Land, unfortunately, but one Watery Grave, one Steam Vents.
All right. So it sounds like we have our work cut out for us. Of course, we will report back with our findings next week.
Sounds good.
Cool. See you on the other side of these tricky cues.
That's a wrap on Valky, God of Lies. Check back next week to find out which Tibalt deck was able to Tibalt the hardest. We have another card to discuss this week, Alrund, God of the Cosmos. So check that out for more freshly brewed decklists. You can follow us on Twitter at FaithlessMTG. And if you'd like to support our podcast, you can join our community at patreon.com/faithlessbrewing. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.